Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me this afternoon is my good friend and co-host, as always,
Chad Mintz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. So, Chad, I received some good news on Twitter today that you have made peace with the Back to the Future community. Please enlighten us as to how this came to be.
I have. So, the latest incarnation of their Blu-ray release came out late last year, and I got it for Christmas. I hadn't watched it yet, but I got it, and I have this pet project I've been working on all summer of digitizing all of my DVDs and Blu-rays. So I finally got around to doing Back to the Future. I won't bore you with all the details, but in there, in downloading the files, part of the Blu-ray, they seem like having like a little slideshow that answers questions. And on the third, for the third movie, there someone asked a question. Well, they had two questions. One was, it was something about Old Biff and bringing the, it was Old Biff doing something. And there was, and they answered, well, you know, since Old Biff went back in time, you can't go back to the time, the future time that they had. So something. And I read that and I was furious. I'm like, you're just saying that he changed the thing so he can't go back, but you still did it in the movie. And I was going to be mad, but then I kept reading. And the next question was, well, you just said he changed the future timeline, but we see him go back. How did this happen? And he went on this big spiel and they said, the basic said we couldn't, you know, we didn't want to take the time in the movie to do it to confuse people, but we did say, yes, if you go back in time, you can't go back to the same time you came from. It does change things. However, we also said when something goes around and changes the past, that future timeline changes around the people. And Doc does say that when Jennifer's knocked out, like, we're going to leave her here. It's going to change around her. She'll never know. So basically their answer was, and it kind of tracks, because if you remember the movie, once he comes back, you just see them on the street. But their answer is he went back in time. And once he went back in time, that future, everything that we see when he comes back is actually the changed future, but we never see anything inside. We just see that neighborhood. So everything changed around them. And from what I remember the movie, Doc, Marty, and Jennifer were never inside. They were just kind of out in the street. So
yeah, the first movie ends with them in the driveway, kissing with the car. And then Doc comes in and says, Marty, you know, we got to go. You get the new time machine and you go off into the into episode two. But at the end of episode three, it's Marty and Jennifer and the train.
Mm-hmm.
And Doc saying that the future is unwritten, and because she presents him with the facts, and she's like, he's like, because that you like Marty decided not to get to race Needles, therefore Needles and gets in the wreck, and Marty does not, and therefore Marty doesn't become a old man who can't play the guitar anymore, therefore he never gets fired by Needles, therefore he never has to work for Needles, he never gets fired.
And they don't even have that life. That life's completely gone.
That life's completely gone. And so that's you know, the interesting dichotomy of that film is that whole deal, because at the end of the day, the film gives two distinct messages. The trilogy gives two distinct messages. The first message is, you know, that fate has a place in our lives and in time. And the second is, the future is unwritten. You know, you can make whatever future you want. Just because things are supposed to, can, could, might, would turn out one way doesn't mean they have to. You know, the last part of that movie, third part of the movie, is a great illustration of that. You know, if he races him because he got called chicken, he runs into the car and has a massive car wreck. And if he doesn't, he, you know, goes on to an unknown future. You know, it's that's the great part of that trilogy is that it has a great message about our fate and about fate and time. So and I'm glad that you were able to make peace with it.
Yeah, they and in those questions, they did talk about it. They did talk about in their minds how they didn't say fate, but they did say that, you know, in time, it does try to like, it no matter what happens, it does try to correct some things where it's like kind of fate-ish. But
like the Final Destination deal with Death's Design, all these kids have to die in the exact order that they were supposed to die.
Kind of, but not as stringent as that. But that was the two things they talked about, that the fate kind of thing, just said in different words, and that, you know, the future is still fluid, it's still unwritten. And so for people like me that had that issue with Back to the Future 2, if you watch it again, all of our principal players are never in a place that can be like identified. They're on an open street. So in theory, when Obif comes back, he's coming back to a changed timeline, and that has changed around Marty and Doc, and they're just not aware of it. So that fixes my problem, and I am now completely fine after being pissed off for like 30 years.
Because it is a throwaway line of dialogue, and it's said very quickly in the flying car as Doc is delivering a whole bunch of exposition. The other thing, yep, too, that I've never really heard them talk a great deal about, and I've heard Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis talk a lot about this movie over the last 30 years, they don't talk a lot about the recasting of Jennifer. They talk a whole lot over the course of time about Crispin Glover and the digital thing and the lawsuits. They talk about the Eric Stoltz or whatever his name was, the guy who was going to play Marty, and then they replaced him with Michael J. Fox 20 days into production. I've heard them talk about those two recastings. I've never really heard them talk a whole lot about the Jennifer one, as to why they did it or what the necessity was, because clearly from the way that you end the first movie, it's clear they wanted to make Jennifer a more active part of 2 and 3 than what she, at least 2, than what she was in the first movie, because she's hardly in it. She's in the beginning and the end, literally. But they went so far as to literally reshoot the ending of 1 with the new actress. So, like...
So that was...
You know, was it like contractual? Was it like, I don't want to come back? Was it an argument of created differences?
I don't think it was. I remember, because just like you, I watched a whole bunch of Back to the Future stuff. And I do remember one of the things I watched, they did talk about this very thing. I can't remember what thing I was watching, but I think it was just as simple as like she might have been doing something else and couldn't come back, so they had to recast her. It wasn't anything like she didn't want to or anything like that. I think it was literally she couldn't come back. Maybe she had another job, or maybe she was like pregnant at the time. It was something like that. So they wanted her back. She just couldn't come back, so they had to recast her. It wasn't any like, we just don't want her or something like that. And actually, you know, Jennifer was recast twice, because when they had Eric Stoltz as Marty McFly, there was another girl that was actually Jennifer. And when they recast him with Michael J. Fox, well, she was taller than Michael J. Fox, so then they had to recast her. And if you've watched The Office and you know who Jan Levinson is, she was originally the first Jennifer, but she's taller than she's taller than Michael J. Fox and had to be recast.
So much fun regarding that movie and, yeah, and its place. And I don't know if you saw the pictures recently, but Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd just did their first con post COVID in DC. They did the DC con and they did a panel where they talked about things, and it was just good to see those two. Fox put up some pictures on his Twitter account, and Christopher Lloyd put some pictures up on his Instagram. It's just cool to see the two of them still around talking about this film, because Lord knows Bob Gale won't shut up about it.
Never. He knows this is his thing and he's going to keep riding it. And I can't blame him.
No. And you know, it was also really weird because I'm in the middle of a Freaks and Geeks rewatch. And it's really weird for me to go through and be like, famous person, famous person, famous person. And then, you know, the coach, the high school gym teacher in that show is Biff.
I've only watched an episode and a half of Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've seen him yet.
Yeah. So Biff is the gym teacher in Freaks and Geeks, and he's also the officer in Camp Nowhere. Like, he's the sheriff of that little town when the guy, the bounty hunter, comes to look for him, you know, where Christopher Lloyd's character is. So, like, as a kid, I didn't put the pieces together, but there's Biff and Doc in the same movie, like, 4 years after Back to the Future.
Yeah, I've seen him in other stuff. Like, he's just popped up here and there.
Really good character actor.
Yeah. And apparently, like, a really nice guy. Everybody really likes him.
I mean, he certainly has always struck me as the kind of guy who's never going to turn a fan away.
Yeah, that's the impression I get.
Indeed. So, Chad, on other Twitter-related news today, I need you to pilot the podcast for a moment because I have a rant.
Oh, okay. Pray tell. So, what is bringing this particular goodness on?
So there was a tweet that was asking you to choose between two films on Twitter. And you can pull that up for me and you can pilot the podcast from there.
See, did you tweet it out too?
I did.
Okay, let me go find this. Oh, okay. Yeah, I can do this because I haven't seen one of these and the other one I hate. So this ought to be good. Okay, so looking at this Twitter question, it's that apparently has triggered Brian. The question is, Fast Times at Ridgemont High or The Breakfast Club? Those are the two choices. No ties. If you didn't like either, keep scrolling. So I think you have a very strong opinion on this. So I'm going to just sit here and listen.
So I would own the book Fast Times at Ridgemont High is based on, if it weren't like out of print and like $900 if you can find it on eBay. So what happened is the backstory to Fast Times at Ridgemont High is that a very young up and coming writer by the name of Cameron Crowe went back to high school about a year or two after graduating college. He still looked young enough to do it. And he went back to high school and he kept a notebook of the things that were going on around him as he was impersonating a high school student. And he turned those notes into the book, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He then took the book and turned it into a screenplay, which was the first screenplay he ever got produced, called Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and that's the movie. The movie is based on the book. And of course, everybody knows about Breakfast Club. Breakfast Club is the story of the kids and the detention with the teacher and the four separate cliques of high school: the pretty girl, the jock, the emo girl, and the rebel. You know, in the four different corners and figuring out they're really not that different and coalescing and then writing that note at the end and the fist in the air and the don't you forget about me and all the things. The movie's written and directed by John Hughes, who was on a huge roll at the time, wrote all the way up until his death in the early 2000s under pseudonyms and different things. He's the man responsible for not only 16 Breakfast Club, but 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink, as well as Beethoven and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So,
and Home Alone.
And Home Alone. So, like, you know, it's not a bad resume for a decade's worth of work. Here's the thing for me. Fast Times is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I love it way more than I ever could Breakfast Club, because while Breakfast Club does touch on some interesting themes, right? Stereotyping, gender roles, teenage angst, authority versus against the machine, you know, all these different kind of themes that they touch on in Breakfast Club. To me, there are other movies that Hughes wrote that were more meaningful to me and expressed the sentiment in a different way. Fast is fantastic for the main reason. Okay, so people mostly think of this movie, they think of two things. They think of Sean Penn as Spicoli, and they think of Phoebe Cates in a bathing suit, almost unbuttoning her top, while Judge Reinhold jerks off to her. Like, that's what people think of. And that's there, certainly. But this is a movie that takes on the issue of women at this particular, a woman in her high school years dealing with the world around her. And similar to Hughes's films where there are no adults, right? If you look at Pretty in Pink, if you look at 16 Candles, there are some adults present, but there's not like adults in the room looking out for what's going on. It's about the kids. In the same way, there are pictures of the parents around in the houses of in Fast Times, but they're not seen, right? They're not major players. So it's about a woman, a young woman, 15, 16, 17 years old, coming of age and figuring out herself and her life while she's working at a mall. And all the kids at the high school work at the mall for the most part. And this is about her going on a journey of self-discovery. She ends up losing her virginity in the in the movie to a dude who's in his 30s, okay, which you would never see today pulled off in any kind of way. But it was done. They acknowledge the age difference. They do it in a dugout. You know, it's a whole deal. But that's just a short-term fling. That leads to her getting with the sports betting guy. This is like whenever I've watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I just picture what Jimmy Ott was like in high school in New Orleans in like the 60s and 70s. And this is that dude. This is the guy you call if you want concert tickets. This is the guy that you call if you want to, you know, place a bet on the game. Like, that's who this guy is. And that dude's best friend is in love with this girl, but he ends up through a set of fate, doing her in her parents' pool house. And the way that, so the scene construction of the two separate events is one of the things that I love about this movie, because it's not sexualized, but it's realistic in the dugout, and it's the passion, and it's the pain, and it's everything that you go through with your first time. And then like the way that the second interaction is framed and shot, and it's quick and jerky, and the camera movements are all over the place, and it's a very hurried, very rushed, very, you know, abrupt ending thing. And it's like, I love that juxtaposition of first time versus second time, love versus lust, experience versus unexperienced. I love that dichotomy. But she gets pregnant after the second time. And she decides that after talking to Phoebe Cates' character, who's her mentor and friend, that she decides to go have an abortion. And the way that they deal with it that moves me is she has a conversation with the guy about how to pay for the procedure. She doesn't want to pay. She wants to pay some, but she wants him to pay some because they decide that that's the right thing to do. And the fact that you even get that conversation in a film where it's like an active discussion about how this real world thing about how to pay for it, the very technical aspects of like, who's going to take you, who's going to bring you home, all these kind of little things that you wouldn't think of. It makes that thing very real in a way that you never see hardly in film. And then after that, when you have the dichotomy of she asks him, he says yes, he then doesn't have the money. So he starts calling up all the people who owe him money from his bookmaking and side ventures, and none of them call him back, or none of them can take care of him at that moment. And so instead of manning up and talking to her and trying to figure something out, he just no-shows her. And so she ends up taking a cab. She ends up walking to the clinic. She gets her brother to drop her off at the corner, saying that she's going to a movie. And she ends up walking to the clinic. And Judge Reinhold, who is her brother, follows her because he has an inkling that something's up. And he ends up picking her up and bringing her home and just promises not to tell parents. And then when Phoebe Cates finds out what the guy did, she paints, a very offensive term on his car. And I love that that's a thing that happens in the movie. It's acknowledged and it's real. And then at the end, when she ends up getting with the friend that had the crush on her originally, that first kiss interaction is also shot differently, framed differently, more in a loving, passionate way than the interaction with the guy who got her pregnant or the interaction with the older dude in the ballpark. So the framing, the music choices, the devices that they use in those moments are what make that film resonate with me in a way that you don't see with any other. Like, this is why I love God. There's a million reasons why I love the Godfather trilogy, or at least the first two movies. One of them is the fact that they tackle this issue in an Italian American Catholic family. Like, the moment that Kay and Michael's relationship dies is the moment where she openly tells him, "I was pregnant. It was a boy. I didn't have a miscarriage. I had an abortion," and he immediately hits her because he's filled with rage because his son was taken from him without his knowledge. And so that is the cardinal sin in that faith and in that family. And so it's at that moment where she literally calls their relationship something unholy and evil that you see that fine and clear break. And so because the topic isn't covered a lot, and because it's now definitely not covered from the female perspective a lot, it makes that character feel very real to me in a way that I don't really feel with any of the characters in Breakfast Club. And I don't feel like any of the topics that are addressed in Breakfast Club are addressed as deeply and meaningfully as the topics that are covered in Fast Times. Because while there are funny moments, like Forrest Whitaker running over everybody in a football game because he believes that somebody else crashed it, somebody from the other team crashed his car, or Brooke Shields and Sean Penn hooking up at the end, or Mr. Pete, the pizza and Mr. Hand and all that. Like, Fast Times just resonates with me on a much deeper level than Breakfast Club. Not that I don't dislike, I prefer one film to the other, but like those three scenes just make that movie stand out.
So that was insightful for me because, I've never seen Fast Times, and honestly, like reading that tweet, I'm like, oh, they're both like these goofball coming of age high school movies. I had no idea about this story running through Fast Times and how, kind of deep it goes. It's much deeper than anything I know of in Breakfast Club, which again, I hate Breakfast Club. So this is, this was at least educational for me for that movie. At some point I'll probably get around to Fast Times. It's just, I've never had a chance to sit down and watch it.
Well, I mean, Fast Times is funny. It is a goofball comedy, but there are problems. Like, and we can get into and segue from this in a moment to our discussion about, once again, another director having comments about the MCU, which pits fans versus cinema nerds versus movie nerds. But, like, I have issues with Fast Times as well. Like, the movie isn't structured great. So, like, the movie will literally jump from the beginning of the semester to the Christmas break. And then after that, go immediately to the end of the school year. So you miss a period of time. They don't do prom. Some story threads are just dropped and then picked back up. The the lab being one of them, and the field trip to the biology class and the field trip to the morgue and all that being an example. But like the in the Mr. Thread, Mr. Hand and Spicoli stuff is cute, but it to me, if you want that kind of a humor, that kind of a play, again, I think Breakfast Club's more fitting in that context. But like it's just for me, it's difficult for me because Judge Reinhold, and the other thing that makes the movie for me is Judge Reinhold, because that character literally is humbled. He goes from being the guy to having one interaction and getting fired to going so losing his within 24 hours, loses his job, loses his girlfriend, you know, and has to go work at a gas station in his senior year of high school. Like, and he ends his senior year of high school by breaking up a robbery, and that leads to other things. But like, the man's brought so low, he's in a pirate costume delivering food. Like, the whole point of what surrounds the masturbation scene is that he is at such a low point in his life that, you know, the best he can hope for is to fantasize about his sister's friend, you know? So it just resonates with me on a much deeper fundamental level than anything in Breakfast Club. And if you're wondering, my favorite John Hughes movie is The Great Outdoors, actually. The Great Outdoors or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the two John Candy. Uncle Buck would also, all three of those John Candy movies would be up there. But that's my thoughts. Like, it just, like, they both have resonant themes, but just the way that those scenes are shot and storytelling is just different in those two movies.
That makes me want to check it out more than I did before, but
because whenever you think about that movie in popular culture terms, you think of Spicoli, you think of Mr. Hand, you think of, again, Phoebe Cates fresh off of Gremlins, like getting ready to, you think, bare her breast. Like, the whole thing. Like, that's what you think of pop culturally. You don't think about the young girl who's actually at the center. As a matter of fact, all of those people I just named are supporting players, but you would never know it by the fact that everybody just talks about all the other extremely famous people who were in that movie.
Yep, that's kind of all I ever hear. So I think I'm going to agree with you on favorite John Hughes movie as The Great Outdoors. It's probably one I've seen the most, ironically, but it's like my mom and my aunt like that movie. So whenever they were together, they were probably watching it. So, and you know, the bald ass bear. I can't ever forget
the literal bald ass bear.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that bear just walked around that same cabin in that same woods, just waiting for 20 years for him to come back.
Big ass bear. Big ass bear.
Yeah. And I love the fact that, in that movie, Hughes deals with something that, again, almost never gets dealt with in any kind of movie like that, is it deals with the idea of living in a transit town, living in a town where the majority of what you do and your livelihood is dependent upon transient people, tourists, people who come in for the summer season to rent cabins, or, you know, people who come just for a fishing season or whatever. And, you know, the nature of love, especially as a young teenager, and falling for somebody who is by definition only there for a brief period of time. And you know, the way that you would guard your heart against that, those kind of things. And those are all there in Great Outdoors, that, again, he was brilliant at layering that stuff in and around, you know, washing machine jokes.
And I never think of that one as a John Hughes movie. I don't know why. Like, as soon as you say, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, it is. The other one that's probably up there is going to be Ferris Bueller.
Yeah,
I love the damn movie.
See, for me, the candy ones are always going to be at the top because I love candy. And my dad loved Candy. So I grew up watching those movies the most. So Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where, you know, Steve Martin being a dick for like so much of that movie. And then as we said, The Great Outdoors. I mean, those are the smaller ones that didn't make a ton of money, but like, you know, those are the ones that I think of when I think of Hughes. That and Beethoven. Cause, you know, as a small kid in the '90s, like you daycare ran Beethoven into the ground about as much as they ran Power Rangers. the three movies in daycare I saw the most were the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers movie, the Fern Gully, and the Weird Back the Dinosaur Story. It's a very weird. That and what was it, Rockadoodle? The one where there's the rainstorm.
I don't know if I've ever actually seen that movie all the way through, but I know what it is. And every now and then I go look it up just to make sure that I wasn't imagining that this thing existed, because nobody else ever says a damn thing about Rockadoodle, but I know it happened.
Elvis Chicken.
Like
animated Elvis Chicken.
I forget. I know I've looked it up, and I looked it up to know that it's loosely based on the Chanticleer tale, and they mix some other stuff in it, but I haven't looked it up in a while to remember exactly what happened, but I've never seen that whole movie.
It's one of two live action hybrids that I enjoy, the other one being The Pagemaster.
I've never seen that one either, but I know what that one is too.
Yeah, see, that surprises me given how much you love libraries and books. Because that whole thing is nothing but a kid who loves books being made fun of and then being translated into a library.
Maybe I have seen that, but it would have been a long, long time ago. And I didn't always love libraries and books.
Yeah, this is Macaulay Culkin at the height of his fame. Which again, we can get into a whole discussion about the career of Macaulay Culkin in the 90s and the the range there of going from Kevin in Home Alone to the kid who dies of bee stings and My Girl to, you know, Richie Rich.
I mean, let's not forget he also had a Saturday morning cartoon. Mm-hmm. Which kid?
Yep. And then the Dennis the Menace remake. It wasn't him, I don't think. But
No, that wasn't him.
Yeah, but the Richie Rich remake was.
Yeah, that was him.
Yeah. So we could spend a whole episode just on the career of Macaulay Culkin from the 90s, but we will save that discussion for another time. Let's move on to the comments that our good friend Mr. Vianville had about the MCU's copy and paste motivations and the fact that the interview is in Spanish.
See, I didn't find the whole interview. I did find his quote, like the whole quote in English. Let me see if I can find it again.
Well, while we're waiting, King Ralph wasn't that. That wasn't Hughes, was it?
I don't think it was. Okay, so I don't have. So I have the pretty much the full quote. I wish I had the question leading into the quote, but I have the quote.
No, it was David Ward. David Ward directed it. Written. It was not written by John Hughes.
This whole situation, it's like a whole bunch of different layers. I'm sure we'll get to all that. But all right, so his quote is, "Perhaps the problem is that we are in front of too many Marvel movies that are nothing more than a cut and paste of others," Villeneuve said. "Perhaps these types of movies have turned us into zombies a bit. But big and expensive movies of great value, there are many today. I don't feel capable of being pessimistic at all." So that's it. That's the entire quote. Oh, wait. And this seems to be, so that's from one interview. Then there's the other one in the same vein from a French outlet from Premiere. He says, "If we're talking about Marvel, the thing is, all these films are made from the same mold. Some filmmakers can add a little color to it, but they're all cast in the same factory. It doesn't take anything away from the movies, but they are formatted." So See, one, it's two different places. Like, it's from two different interviews where he has these Marvel quotes, and people have been putting them together. But that's the gist of what that's. Those are his exact words from those two different places. Well, one of them is translated from Spanish. The other one, I think, is in English.
So basically what I'm hearing there is I am resentful of anything made in the 1920s, 30s, because those anything during the studio era of Hollywood was manufactured and designed. All the Shirley Temple movies were churned out very quickly under studio contract and studio design. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer himself running many of those productions. Like, that has definitely been a thing that has happened across time, you know? And it's not just a thing that's unique to Marvel. Like, you know, your favorite franchise, the Transformers. What's the name of that dude who produces those? Louis DiGiovanni or whatever his name is. Like, it's the same guy who's been producing them since the beginning, and he's the one who makes the choices about filmmakers. He's the one that decided to keep Michael Bay's aesthetic going for so many films. Like, you know, part of the reason DC's in the mess that they're in is because they don't have a producer that's guiding the vision to mold all these films in the way they ought to go. I mean, we're back in the studio era, and I get it. Like, our tours flourished and became a thing in the 1970s, in that Renaissance period of the 70s and 80s, where the studio system finally was, you know, starting with Easy Rider in late 60s, early 70s, you know, the studio system was finally nailed into the ground, into the coffin, and buried. And you got people like Roman Polanski, you got people like Woody Allen, you got people like Francis Ford Coppola, you got people like George Lucas, and later you would get people like Spielberg and people like Sidney Lumet and you know, David Lynch and all these Edgar Wright, you know, all of these different niche auteur directors who, you know, Wes Anderson, who make very much films in their own way, but they're like, they have the creative freedom. They have the, you know, they can go get their financing. They can do all these things. What I think he's lamenting there is more or less, not the marvel of it all, but the death of that, the things have cycled back around, that we've gone from the studio system to our tourism, and now we're sliding back into studio, you know, the studio system. And I think he's freaking out and panicking about that, because he very much considers himself an auteur, and that even though he's playing with budgets in the $150, $200 million range, he still does things, you know, in a very unique and cultured way. Whereas, you know, Marvel just hires the guy who, you know, did Bring It On to make a box cut Ant-Man movie. You know, and that's kind of the thing that I think he's talking about there, is he's lamenting more the death of the cycle of studio system, auteurism, back to studio system.
Okay, so I'm gonna get to him, but I want to get to him last. So, looking at these two quotes, this is why I wish I had the questions preceding them, but not with the first one so much. It looks like, I'm inferring, I could be totally wrong, but it looks like the first one, he brings Marvel into the situation. The second one, is he's directly saying, if we're talking about Marvel. So it makes me wonder, whatever outlet this is, that they bring up Marvel first. So the first thing I want to talk about is, I just want to say that, you know, we have these outlets whenever these big movies are coming out, whenever these, you have any kind of director of note, all of these outlets always want to ask them about Marvel movies, to get them on the record about Marvel movies, because they know if they have opinions about Marvel movies, good or bad, and they put that in their little headlines, they're going to get all the clicks. So one, I wish the outlets would stop doing that, especially if these people have nothing to do with Marvel movies. Just it's talk about their movie. Don't have to bring up Marvel to kick the amp out, so to speak. They're purposely starting this so they can get views and clicks. I get that why they want to do it, but there's nothing productive that comes out of that. We just have this fight. Now for Villeneuve himself, I think you're on the right track with that. Particularly looking at this first quote that I think is just him bringing up Marvel. And yeah, he's got an issue with the studio-ness of it. And we're in the habit now of when people hear it's a studio movie, that's a bad thing. That is a negative thing. When it's producer driven, that is a negative thing. And I mean, that's your right to feel that way. But this is still, at the end of the day, this is still storytelling. And it's just it's not the preferred storytelling that you have. If you think that directors are the end all be all, then they should be the final word on what movies are. And that's fine for what you want to do. But with Marvel, the way they're going, and that all of these movies are taking place more or less in the same place in the same time, to keep track of all that, to keep it all going, they've made it studio driven, they've made it producer driven, and it's worked for them. And people like it. It's entertaining. So what if it's not your cup of tea? You just have to accept it and do what you want to do. I mean, there are plenty of other studios. Hell, the studio that you're making your big budget movie with, they love to gear it towards auteurs. So fine. But when you comment on Marvel movies and it's not your cup of tea, all it makes you come across is, it makes you come across as resentful and bitter that these movies are doing so well and what you consider real auteur-driven films more likely than not are not doing as well. And you see that as a problem. And all it's going to do is what these quotes did, which was cause a fight, be divisive. So then you got people on both sides screaming at the other side. And one side is like, now they dug in their heels. They're not going to support what you're doing no matter what, because you've attacked the thing that they like. Instead of just saying, you know, they do it this way, I do it this way. And those are two completely valid ways of doing it and going about your business. You caused this fight. And we've seen enough of this to know that that's what it's going to cause. And all you're doing is cutting off your nose to spite your face, because I mean, I'm not the biggest sci-fi guy, but there's a lot of people that like Marvel, that like sci-fi stuff, that might actually get into Dune, but they're not going to go now because like you're attacking the things that I like. So instead of you bringing somebody in to something they didn't know, and then you could turn then they can be exposed to what you do, and maybe they'll like some more auteur-driven stuff and you know, branch off and become a more, you know, quote-unquote well-rounded film person. You've offended them, and now they turn off to you completely. So it just, there's no benefit in talking about this if you're a director and you don't like the Marvel style. Just say that's not what you want. That's not how you work, but there's nothing wrong with it, because that's what it is. There's nothing wrong with either side.
The thing that drives people like Scorsese and Bienville and to a lesser extent Spielberg to make these kinds of comments, and it's ironic coming from Spielberg, but it is that they are fighting a war on two different fronts. They're fighting the streaming war, and they're also fighting the financing war. And what basically those guys are upset about is the fact that slowly but surely, from the early to mid 90s to now, slowly but surely, there's been a decline in financing of art, like true artur stuff. the kind of stuff that A24 does, the kind of stuff that Neon does, the kind of stuff that Fox Searchlight does. They're upset because back in the day, in the Renaissance era of the Artur, even into the late 80s, you could go to a major studio and get those things financed and marketed to a larger audience. Now, it is so specialized, and they rightly or wrongly blame blockbusters, like big tentpole movies, and in this moment, as in the last decade, they blame Marvel. If you go and you read Scorsese's comment about theme park rides and theme park movies and whatever else you want to say, if you actually read the full thing in quotes, the full quote in context, what he's talking about there is theater counts. Like, if you've got a 16-screen auditorium and Marvel and / Disney says you have to book at least half of these for 8 weeks with my latest Marvel movie, or else I won't give you the next Marvel movie, the theater owner and the booker are forced to oblige to that because they need the Marvel movie to drive the content, to drive the money and the ticket sales and the concession revenue. And so they will acquiesce to Disney and do that. And so with that taking up 8 screens, that's 8 other screens for the other studios plus the smaller ones. And so you are slowly but surely cutting off the venues for them to show their art. And then if you slowly cut off the venues to show their art, then the money reduces. The amount of profit they make reduces because they can't be seen for very long, and not, and there's the theatrical release windows aren't very long and they're not very profitable. And therefore, less of them get made, especially in an environment where over the last 15 years, we've really moved from, you know, low, medium, and large budget to mega budget, micro budget, and nothing in between. And so when directors like Vienville and Scorsese talk about these things, they're talking about them because they feel their brand of filmmaking is going extinct and that they are being pushed out slowly but surely, and the fault of it is the profit-making mindset of mega corporations that own studios. And so that's the larger context of the conversation they're trying to have. What it gets wrapped up in is, oh, you're a bitter old man who doesn't like the new thing.
Yeah.
And it's not that, it's that their livelihood, the films they wanted to make, the films that they have made that have made them these tremendous auteur voices, can't get made now. And it scares the shit out of them because they want to have people come behind them who will make that kind of art. And they're worried there won't be a place or a home for them to do that. And so if streaming takes theaters out, or if Marvel continues to dominate and Disney continues to impose theater count minimums, then slowly but surely they're going to go extinct. And I don't know about you, but I've never known a entity or a person or a species that has taken to, you know, a complete eradication very well. You know, I saw the finale of Dinosaurs. Very dark. You know, no one really takes that stuff very well. So that's the context of what you've got to understand, is they're scared to death that their way of filmmaking is done.
I mean, I get that. And that's, you know, that's a good way to put it, to kind of, you know, change perspectives on it.
Because whenever I read this kind of stuff, I view it as Marvel in the abstract. Marvel is a word, is a term for blockbuster. Marvel is a word or a term for comic book movie. Marvel is a word or a term for Disney. Like, it's a stand-in word. It's not about Infinity War. It's not about Endgames. Not about Black Panther or Captain Marvel, or the quality of those films, or the writing, or the directing, or the art direction, or set design, or anything else that tangibly has to do with Marvel Movie X. It is about what the Marvel brand represents and what it's being used to symbolize.
No, I get that. But like, okay, so if you're going to do that, that is completely within their rights. And again, it is like a bit like, you know, cornering a wild animal, and they know that, you know, their survival depends on, you know, fighting back. But what's their end game? Because if you're going to attack, all you're doing is attacking the most popular form of movies on the planet right now. And no matter why they're doing it, it comes off as condescending to the people that like those movies. So all it does is it alienates people that might give you a chance at something else. So I understand you feel threatened and you see the things that you want to do maybe going away, and you're focusing all your hatred on the biggest thing on the block because you feel like they're muscling everything out. But again, the people that like it, when you say those things, it sounds like, oh, so I like trash, and you're saying this trash, and I like trash. So why am I ever going to go see anything you put out, because you think my taste is garbage as it is? That's no, you're not growing people to come and see your things. You'll always have your niche. It is a niche, like, you know, art house Twitter people that are going to go see those kind of movies, but you're not going to bring anybody else in, and you can't keep making the things if nobody but that small group is going to go see your stuff.
Well, I mean, I'd argue that Scorsese's, you know, made a whole bunch of money off of Wolf of Wall Street, right? Like, they can pop one off every now and then, but like, I do agree with you that they should, like, if they were attacking Jaws, you know, they haven't made a Jaws movie. Universal hasn't made a Jaws movie since what, the late 80s? So like,
something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Jaws is a dead franchise, but it's a franchise. What if instead of using the Marvel as the term, what if they used Jaws as the term? Would the reaction be as great? Would the ire be as great? Would people be pitchforking and torching these directors to the point where Martin Scorsese's own granddaughter just gifted him a bunch of Marvel movies for Christmas that year? Like, you know?
I think it's different because people will call them out, because people consider Jaws to be one of those, it's, you know, it's often credited as the first blockbuster, but it's also viewed as this auteur-driven film. So people will be more apt to say, nah, we're calling BS on this, because Jaws is the kind of thing that it sounds like you should be defending. So you're mistaken.
True, the same time, remember, we got Jaws 3D. We got Jaws the Revenge. Like, Universal mined that ship into the ground. And Spielberg gladly lent out his name to many, many things over the last 30 years as a producer that were not great.
Yep, but that's not what people think when they think Jaws. They think the first one. Like, I know that they have those trash movies. I know they exist. But when you say Jaws, my mind immediately goes just to the first one, and I kind of forget about those other ones. Even though you just told me we're talking about a franchise, you said Jaws, I just forgot all the bad things and went straight to that one. And that's what everybody's going to do with, like, Jaws. Now, you can do, it's a smaller thing, but, like, maybe, like, Rocky. Because when you say Rocky, I don't just go to the first one. I think of the whole franchise, and you'd be like, see, they made a franchise out of that. But again, people start like, but it was auteur driven. And then you can point out that, well, clearly they just went from the money from like four or five. But then they're like, but it went back to auteur driven for Creed. And people will defend what they want to defend. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make.
Are there Jurassic World defenders? I know there are Jurassic Park defenders, but are there really Jurassic World defenders? Like, clearly both films have made $1 billion, but I mean, you know, I don't see anybody jumping up and down and saying, you know, let me defend this. But anyway, like I said, I just think the reaction would be different if it was something else. Just using Marvel The MCU has a bunch of fans. People get defensive. And you're right. It does get taken a lot of times in context as you're criticizing my taste in film. And I hate that. I absolutely hate that because I'm a guy who I'm sitting here right now. I've got my phone. I've got my tickets for both Bond. And I've got my tickets for Bond, Venom, and Doom. So, like, I'm going to go see the two popcorn movies, but I'm also going to go see the long-awaited adaptation by the Ardour. You know, you're talking to a guy who, yes, has seen the Incredible Hulk movie way too many times than he should, but I'm also the guy who just went on a very long rant about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which is not a was not a high-profile, big-budget movie, and also a guy who bet money on Parasite to win the best picture of the year after seeing it in a small art house theater in New Orleans. Like, you know, we don't, just because I'm an MCU guy and I can tell you the history of the MCU and I want to write a book about it, doesn't mean I don't love the other stuff and vice versa. Just because somebody is considered a classicalist doesn't necessarily mean they don't like the modern stuff. And even in comic books, different authors have different perspectives on different characters, right? When you talk about Batman, you don't talk about a single run of Batman comics. You talk about different runs by different authors. It's, you know, the same character, right? But different interpretations by different people. Like, you know, like that's the whole thing. And that's what makes the next conversation that I want to end with is our boy Christopher Nolan did decide to take his ball and go home, and when he's going to shop his next movie over to, at Universal. Your thoughts on Universal landing him and him actually doing the thing of breaking up with Warner Brothers like he said he would?
You know, this dropped like right after we recorded last week, and I was like, look at this. This is like kind of exactly what we were talking about. I'm not surprised that it's, well, I guess I'm not surprised that he went with the studio because he is Christopher Nolan and he has made it very clear his ideas on like streaming models and whatnot. So yeah, he could have gone and been kind of hypocritical and gone with like Netflix or something and forced them into some of his demands, which we will talk about. But it makes sense for him to go with like a traditional movie studio and one that would go with a model that would suit his needs. The thing that gets me with this is we've talked about it before. He's had diminishing returns over the box office from pretty much from Interstellar on. It's been, you know, less and less, and then we get to Tenet, and I know Tenet has the whole COVID thing, but it's his lowest earner to date. And the movie he's bringing to Universal is about the Manhattan Project, I think, mm-hmm. and the building of the A-bomb, which is not his normal kind of blockbustery fanfare. This is more in the vein of Dunkirk, and even then, I still think this sounds a little bit smaller than Dunkirk. This does not seem like subject matter that lends itself to being in his typical July blockbuster window. It seems smaller, which inevitably should come with a smaller box office. So the biggest surprise to me is the content of this movie, because in all of this hoopla of everything else, you would think that he would want to do something a little bit bigger, but he's sticking with this, and with the price that he's asking for and all these other demands, I mean, I think it's a big ask to make this exact movie.
So just to remind everybody, unadjusted for inflation, his movies are as follows since Interstellar. So Inception is in 2010. 826.1. Interstellar is then 677.5. Dunkirk is then 525.2. So it is Inception at 826, Interstellar at 677, Dunkirk at 525.2, and then whatever happened with Tenet in there as well. So yes, diminishing returns. I don't know. To me, I was surprised he actually took his ball and went home. As we talked last week, I was surprised that Warner Brothers didn't placate to him and get on their knees for him because he is an auteur. But I think there were harsh feelings on both sides. I feel like there were a lot of people at Warner's who were pissed off about the way he treated them during this, in the spot that he put them in during this global pandemic. And I think that there was, you know, one of those mutual respect things where you just, you know, okay, we'll let you walk away. You know, it's, you know, and we can have the discussion as me and Nathan had on Twitter about the role of the direct of the financiers and the producer and how much that, where your film backing comes from, how much that impacts your story and the way you present your film. But I mean, man, to see him actually pick up and go home was something weird.
Because of the way this went and because of how public it was, I think Warner Brothers had no choice but to let him go. We've seen Warner Brothers negotiate with terrorists before and how that turned out for them. They had to...
Still on that, huh?
Yeah. You doing it once is a mistake. Doing it twice means you're pretty much telling everybody, you can do and say whatever you want, and we're just going to let you do it. They kind of had to take this stand. They had to let him walk away, as much as it pains them, because, you know, I've said it before, he's like their biggest drawing auteur. So for everybody, this had to be a break. Now, is it a long break? Is this a permanent break? It's yet to be seen. We'll see how he likes dealing with Universal. But, Warner Bros. Has to let him walk away. And then, and where it gets interesting for me is, you know, again, I've said I'm kind of perplexed by what his next project is. And if we didn't find out what he wanted to make this movie, I probably wouldn't even think about what the content of the movie is. I would be like, oh, maybe it's a smaller thing. Maybe it's a smaller budget, whatever. But he has some demands on him, and for starting off with a $100 million budget for the movie, I don't understand why he needs so much to make this movie. And that starts the red flags. I'm reading, this is from IGN. They call this a smaller scale compared to his other projects, which is true because he's done, you know, those Batman
Tenet
movies.
Tenet was $200 million budget on Tenet.
Yeah, he's done these insanely budgeted movies. But it still seems like this movie, this particular movie, should be less than $100 million. Like, 70, if they would have said 75, I'd have been like, oh, okay, that's cool. And it's Christopher Nolan. Oh, yeah, that's fine. But 100, it just seems big for this. But besides that, again, this is from IGN. He's requested equal marketing budget. So to me, that's like the marketing budget has to be the exact amount as the total of the production budget. So it's not $100 million now. We're already at $200 million. He wants total creative control, 20% of the first dollar gross, a blackout period from which the movie, wherein the company would not release another movie 3 weeks before this movie releases, 3 weeks after this movie releases. So it's a 6-week, it looks like a 6-week window where this movie comes out and Universal can't release anything within that window. And he also wants at least 100 days in theaters. So right now, the studios, because of the pandemic, they've cut that from 90 days to what, 45 days. He wants
65 in some cases.
65 in some cases. Well, he wants more than what they originally were getting, which is 90. So a whole 100-day theatrical total. Yeah, those are his demands, and that is just
reads like wild to me. Reads like a list of our tour demands, doesn't it?
It does. Now, so looking at like the theatrical window. Again, we just said, doesn't seem like this should be a summer movie, but let's say it is. Let's say that they decide, you know, it's Christopher Nolan, we're going to give him a summer release because we're paying this much for this movie. So if Universal puts this movie in like the last week of June, that pretty much means they can't put anything in the entire month of June before it. And they've only got until they can't drop anything until like the last week of July, probably August, for something for them to drop because of this window he has. That's basically the whole summer is a wash for Universal if they drop this movie in June because of his 6-week window. That's when most people make all their money. It just seems insane. Now they can, you know, stick it in October. I guess that's better. They'll get it out. They will get it out after the summer rush and before we get to the holiday stuff.
Right, but if you do it in November, which is the prime award season window, you do it at Thanksgiving, your entire holiday schedule is done. Yep. So
it seems so excessive.
Hand tying.
I mean, I know studios don't put movies on top of each other if they can anyway, but I think it's the fact that they had 3 weeks before and below. I think if it was like, you know, 3 weeks below, it would seem better. It's basically a 6 week block. I don't know, man.
That ties a booker's hands.
Yes, exactly. It's a huge demand for any studio. Damn it. I wish I could, if Box Office Mojo was still a thing we could actually look at, I would kind of go back and look and see what like a normal release calendar looks like and see how far apart studios movies were. I know they don't put like big against big, like big right after big, but you know, if there's big and then something smaller they can stick in a couple weeks later, go for it. But it just seems like a really, really big ass. But Universal, I mean, they're about to wrap up their Fast franchise. And I mean, what else do they...
They're about to wrap up their Jurassic World franchise too.
Yeah. The biggest on the books franchises are Jurassic World and the Fast series. Both are about to wrap up. Jurassic World's already shot. They're about to start working on this Fast stuff. But what other big thing do they have? So I guess their gamble is, we'll gamble on Nolan. He is a director whose name typically, well, in people's minds, draws people to theaters. This movie, I think, is going to really test that because of the subject matter. It's like, even though Tenet did, you know, what it did, it was because of COVID. Because it had that sci-fi feel and it had Nolan's name attached, it would have done good to decent business, especially in the beginning. Inception, same thing. Interstellar, no matter how you feel about that movie, it was the same kind of thing. Dunkirk, I think, was hurt because, I mean, I don't want to say hurt, but it did what it did because it's, you know, based on on like real life events, same as this. So I think it's going to do parallel to what Dunkirk did in the best case scenario. And I think it's going to do worse than Dunkirk.
Dunkirk had the added advantage of being a premium large format film that you needed to see in that format to really get the full embrace of what he was trying to do. You don't have that. I don't think you're going to have that with this particular thing. I'm sure he'll shoot it in IMAX, but I don't think it'll be one of those things where you have to see it in IMAX. Yeah. You're right. It's not a popular subject matter. It's not going to be a popcorn movie, because you can argue that Inception and Interstellar, as well as, Tenet, all have that element of popular, popular features to them. I mean, Tenet is basically a spy movie. But, I don't know, man. It's just, they have a very successful awards arm in focus features. So it's not like they need an Oscar push. I don't really understand tying your hands and complying with all of the hostage takers' demands in order to get what? $200 million, $300 million back? Like, is that really worth everything to you, when you've got other things that can make you that much money 3 weeks before and 3 weeks after?
I don't think it's going to give them that much of a profit. I mean, you pulled up Dunkirk's numbers. What did Dunkirk make?
Give me a second. Again, we this is the part of the podcast where we complain that Box Office Mojo is no longer a thing.
Yeah, man, this it really sucks that we can't just go to Box Office Mojo. It was so helpful and so quick.
Thank you, IMDb corporate overlords. Let's see. So it had a $100 to $150 million budget, and it made $526.9 million.
Okay, so using those numbers and going by what we know of with this his new movie, first off, we know the production is 100, but we also know marketing is going to be equal to that. So that's another 100. So we're looking at $200 million off top. And the typical rule is you have to make
double
what that is. So you're looking at double to make a profit. So you're looking at, you have to hit 400 before you're even making a profit in this movie. And you just said Dunkirk did what, 568. So, I mean, no, I'm not gonna give them the benefit of the doubt. So they did. I give them 570. They did 570. So they made $170 million worth of profit on this. That, I mean, I guess, I don't know how the studio felt about that. I guess they're happy with that. I don't know.
Well, they got award notices. When you do a thing like that, you are wanting award notices. At this point, if you're hiring Christopher Nolan to do a World War II film, you are hiring him to make an Oscar bait movie. And I know people get triggered when you use the term Oscar bait, but like, you were hiring him to make a movie that will get you awards notices. Maybe not wins, but at least notices. Because notices themselves can lead to larger audience shares and rewatches and re-releases and all the things. So like, you're not hiring this dude to make a Jurassic Park movie. You're not hiring this dude to make the Fast and the Furious 10. You're hiring this dude to make a World War II movie that he wants to make for $200 million, $100 million plus $100 million in marketing, $200 million, so that you can hopefully get some award notices and drive some more traffic toward your awards arm. And you look good because you are helping an auteur, so you're seen as an open door studio, whereas other studios are now seeing as studio and closed off.
If awards are what they're doing it for, then good luck to them. They might be able to pull that off, particularly with this one. But I mean, that's a big gamble, but if that's what they want to do, hey, you know, go for it, bro.
Indeed. That'll about do it for this week's podcast. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
At the Mets Theory.
Thank you very much. And this is your public service announcement that Mark Sanchez was not the worst quarterback in Washington Redskins / Washington football team history. Thank you very much and have a good evening.
I mean, they had Gus Frat. For us?
Yes. What did we learn this weekend?
That there's lots of talent in the skill positions on offense. That this team will go as far as the offensive line is going to take it. That should worry everybody. And that the defense is good. Defense can be good. I think they'll be, regardless of what happens, I think they'll be better than last year. And in this day and age of college football, if you can hold them to 28 and under, I think you do a pretty good job. And I think the defense, I think that's what we're looking at for this defense. Ain't going to strangle people to death, but it'll give you a chance.
I would agree with that assessment. When the quarterback has time, he can make the right throws, and he has multiple reads that he can go to. The issue is going to be that offensive line and keeping him upright. And on the defensive side of the ball, I mean, they look more comfortable, and I think they look more comfortable because the communication is better. And I also think it helps that you're going back to an Aranda-style defense. So the coding and the language is something similar, you know, whereas Pelini had kind of brought in something that they didn't quite grasp or understand. So.
Yeah. I came out of that feeling better about them because they did show progress. I know it's Central Michigan, but Central Michigan is a step up from McNeese, who they, you know, beat, but were unimpressive against. Central Michigan without your damn pick six. You blew them out, but without the pick six, it looks a lot worse. So just pray the line can hold up enough and that they can manufacture enough of a running game to get through the rest of the year.
I think it also helps, Chad, that after the weekend, you feel better about your chances against Kentucky and State. That little stretch there doesn't seem nearly as daunting as it did a week ago or 2 weeks ago. You've gotten better. Those two teams have struggled against lesser competition. In State's case, they're coming off of a very weird and wacky loss to Memphis. So, I mean... And Kentucky is eking by in games where they should be blowing people out. So those two games don't feel nearly as sketchy. I do still feel very sketchy about Auburn because they went up to Happy Valley and really, you know, played well. Bo Nix was not the reason they lost that game. And, you know, I'm also worried about, obviously, Florida, Bama, and Ole Miss, because Ole Miss looks like they have actually gotten a little bit better on defense. And as you just got finished saying, if you hold people to under 28 and you can score 40, you stand a pretty good chance in this league.
Yeah. And yeah, that's exactly what Ole Miss is. So honestly, looking ahead, because of how Ole Miss is, I would not be surprised to lose that one. And I'm fine with that. I'm not as high on Auburn as you seem to be. I know they went up to Penn State and looked, you know, well, but it's still Bo Nix, and I still don't trust him worth a damn. And I don't really think that much about Brian Harsin either. So I think they can win the next 2 weeks. Again, I'm not as high on Florida as you. However, watching that game, I would give the edge to Florida. I would give the edge to Bama. Arkansas is probably going to – well, not probably. Arkansas would be tough. And it depends on what A&M you get at the end of the year.
I think Arkansas finishes second in the West at this point. While I'm giving a whole lot of credit to that Texas win, I'm also looking at the way they're playing. And they are the closest thing to old school SEC football right now that you can find in our league. And I think that they have the defense to shut down other people than Bama. And that's the key there. You're not going to beat Bama, but can you, you know, how can you do against the other four, the other five, that determines how your season goes. And, you know, I think Arkansas has enough, you know, enough favorable things on their schedule to make it worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying second. I would actually lean towards having Ole Miss as second. Arkansas, I think Arkansas is playing for third.
Yeah, well, crazy things happen in that Arkansas-Ole Miss series. see multiple overtimes and laterals.
This is true. But, you know, I think, yeah, Arkansas is good. They play A&M this weekend, and I kind of expect them to work A&M. Yeah, I kind of expect them to work A&M, and A&M to really regret signing on to that marquee arena. Even though I think this is the last year of that one, but I think Arkansas is going to work them and embarrass them. And yeah, so I don't know. I think LSU is probably going to, if I had to pick right now, I think they lose to Ole Miss. And the best they can hope for is splitting between Bama and Florida and like Arkansas and A&M. I think they beat State. I think they beat Auburn.
Yeah, I mean, and then you've got the Kentucky cross matchup, which I think would be in LSU's favor right now.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's going to be interesting in an old school late night 8 o'clock kickoff for that Auburn LSU game. So
look, I know the crazies like the night games. I get it. I like the night games. I like the tradition of night games. But 8 o'clock, man, goddamn! I mean, you really and truly. I know everybody hates the 2:30 games. They were my favorite because I don't have to be sitting around waiting all day. 2:30 hits. We're done by like six. I can go about my day. I can either go joy drinking or drink myself to sleep, one of the two things, and I don't have to be up till freaking midnight. But you crazies, you want the night games, you get this is deep in the night. Hope y'all enjoy it.